I am talking to you.
And the talk just keeps on coming. TalkZone.com. Today's compelling talk radio. It's the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com.
Welcome back to the Baum Show. Nice to have you aboard. First time listener or been with us since the very beginning. And that doesn't seem to be too long ago. But we sure have covered a lot of bases in the shows that we've done. We appreciate your support. Appreciate your calls. We appreciate your emails. At 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888-463-6748. In over 65 countries, 2,600 cities. And we'll give you an opportunity to get into this one as a caller a little bit later, because this is kind of fun. It's kind of fun. I won't tell you any more than that. It's kind of fun. The use of the word futurist, F-U-T-U-R-I-S-T, goes back more than 160 years to Christian scripture. Through the advancing years, we've thought of people like Jules Verne, H.G. Wells in that way, philosophers of foresight. That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? A philosopher of foresight. In the 40s came professional futurists like the RAND, R-A-N-D, and SRI, who looked at long-range planning. Moving the clock ahead in the 70s, I recall one of the best interviews I thought at the time I'd done. Interviewed Alvin Toffler. That name ring a bell to some of you who are older than 25? Now, the book was called Mega Trends, an overnight sensation at the New School. This is over 30 years ago. It's all about plausible scenarios, trends, market opportunities, and risk management. If you read up on futurists, you find out it's the possible, the probable, the preferable, and sometimes a wild card. Dr. Michael Zay is a futurist, sociologist, and trend explainer. He's a faculty member at Montclair State University in New Jersey, specializing in social, economic, and technological trends, and the author of numerous books, including the latest, Ageless Nation. Dr. Zay, welcome to the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
What's the difference between someone who predicts the future by reading your palm, looking at tea leaves, who is blessed, and a futurist like yourself?
They probably have a lot more clients, first off. One of the differences is that we use charts. We use statistical analysis, probability theory. Actually, the more you think about it, it's you might as well look at your palm sometimes, because if you look at the election yesterday, you know how much we can trust numbers. But a futurist basically are people who spend most of the time thinking about the future, writing about it, maybe consult the corporations and try to think about the future. I mean, we have different names for people like this. Most corporations have strategic planners.
Right.
People who work in that, and they, if you invest in a mutual fund, most of these people, most of your market managers there who are managing the fund are working with very complex stochastic forecasting and using numbers and basing, unfortunately, most of what they base it on is the past. That's all they have. And trying to project into the future to get the best mix of stocks in your particular portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you mentioned wild cards. I mean, one can have the best stock portfolio in the world, and something like 9/11 comes, or we have a suspended presidential election like we had in 2000, and suddenly there are huge percentages of your portfolio is suddenly evaporating as you sit, and nobody guesses that this is going to happen. So working with wild cards is very important in trying to project the future. And I always advise people who are thinking about the future is to throw one of those in there. What is the one thing you would never expect, and what impact would it have on you?
Was there a conscious desire on your part as you were growing up, high school, going to college, to do this for a living, or did you happen to stumble into it?
I very early on, well, I think most of us who were in this not only predict the future, but have a concept of a desirable future, which is, you know, you have to kind of separate those in terms of what is going to happen versus what you would like to happen. I mean, most of the books that I've written are both predictive and, I guess you would say, proscriptive. They talk about what ought to be and what will be, and or what is likely to be and what one can do to affect that. I mean, I wrote Seizing the Future in the 90s, and I was looking for a certain type of world, which I'm still looking for, and I basically make my predictions within the focus of what I think ought to happen and how close we are getting to it, and if we're veering from it. And I kind of judge everyone from politicians to governments in terms of, you know, meeting certain criteria about the future. And I should tell you, most of my philosophy is basically very pro-growth, very pro-technology, very pro-human, which is very radical.
That was my sense in looking up some of the things that you've accomplished, that you're basically a very positive guy with a positive view of the future. On the other hand, having spent my whole life as a reporter and an asker of questions, and obviously growing in cynicism and sarcasm, I begin to wonder whether or not the more you look at where we are now and where we're going. I just finished a second segment I've done on Pakistan, and it becomes perfectly obvious to me that if you were a futurist, you would probably say to our political leaders, regardless of who they are, the past is a prologue to the future. Why don't you look at the past, because it can give you answers to the future? But our politicians never do.
Well, they surround themselves with people. I remember Kennedy always surrounded, JFK surrounded himself with people like Schlesinger, Office Schlesinger, and it was not by mistake that he had, you know, he intended to have historians as part of his group. Now, did they learn from the past? Well, if you remember, JFK was one of the people who kind of introduced us into the Vietnam scenario. You know, most people don't remember that. We think we associated with the presidents beyond that. But, you know, looking at this kind of incursion, you know, we've been warned time and time again not to go in those directions, especially foreign wars. But, you know, you hope that people will actually learn from the past and base it on it. But it that implies that people know the past. And that's not easy, certainly in our culture, which is, quite frankly, we're not past-oriented, we're not future-oriented, we're present-oriented, almost to the minute. And what happens yesterday is almost forgotten. And it always amazes me that people can't have any perspective whatsoever in saying, well, look what happened 2 months ago. And people, in fact, when you talk to people, sometimes people will say, something happens 2 years ago, and you say, no. That happened 4 months ago. I say, oh, that's right. they push things back incredibly into the past when it was recent history. And it, you know, it may be human nature that we just don't learn, but it seems to be, maybe it's part of the media that we, you know, we're looking at one news story after another and we just kind of scrap that after, you know, we're moving to the news story.
Well, I think you're right. We become inured to today's news and yesterday's news because it all becomes kind of blurry and all looks kind of like the same. But from a futurist point of view, how much of the past is embedded in the homework you do to take a look at the future?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the only way you can make comparisons, if I'm looking at the present, and you know, we always hear these dire predictions about, you know, and dire descriptions of the present, and you know, you're listening to these candidates going on and on about, you know, things are so bad, now we have to change them. And, you know, you say, well, kind of put flesh on the bones here. What do you mean it's so bad? 50 years ago, people were, or 100 years ago, people were living to 47 years of age in this country. Now they're living to 80. People are healthier than they ever were. We have antibiotics which eliminate problems that would have killed you, even 60 years ago in the 1940s. You know, that's changed. People are, relatively speaking, more affluent than they were. Their standard of living is higher. And I know that people say, well, people are not happy, or they express unhappiness with their own situation or with the world situation. But in reality, if you take a step back, you see how far we've actually come in 100 years. And it is really incredible the kind of, if you looked at human history, it was kind of like we were trudging along for thousands of years. And then around 1800, you know, you suddenly see this upward increase in just technology and the way we live. Around 1900, it starts to increase, accelerate. And then in the lifetime, most of the folks here, certainly boomers, have seen an incredible expansion in terms of human capabilities, the human lifespan, human health, and human affluence. So that I like to keep in mind when I'm making predictions about the future, to see that the lifestyle has actually changed in a very positive way. Also, we've brought more of the world into that lifestyle. Japan was a basket case after World War II. Most of the countries that we're talking about now as being affluent, like Thailand and all that, were backward. I mean, they literally were not even part of the industrialized society. So we've brought more of those folks in. Granted, there are problems around the world. Don't get me wrong, but you have to have some perspective to see where we've come.
I'm wondering, and our guest on the Dave Baum Show is Dr. Michael Zay, a futurist. We've got some very, very interesting things to talk about momentarily. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about based upon our discussion so far is the word being used by most candidates in this country in primaries is change. Now, you never really get them to truly define what change is, but from your perspective, when they talk about change, are they trying to project the image to potential voters about utopia? That their definition of change really means utopia and a better world tomorrow.
It's either a better world tomorrow, or if they think the electorate sees the world today as being somehow imperfect, that we'll move away from that. In other words, not that I will necessarily bring you utopia, but I'll take you out of the flaming pot here. You know, I mean, it's so horrible now, I'll move you further. I would be more impressed, quite frankly, if somebody used the word progress. Because change, as you know, is a code word. To me, it means that someone doesn't want to tell me what's coming up next.
Right.
What do you have planned for me? Well, there'll be change, and people say change is good. Well, some change is good. I mean, if you cut my salary in half, that's radical change. It's not positive. It's just radical change. Progress, I would be able to define that for you, or at least I'd get to know what it is that you want to change me towards, because if you start using words like progress or improvement, then, you know, the reason they don't use that is because that leads to questions like,
and specifics.
What are you going to do, and what do you want to accomplish, and how are you going to do it? And then you have to make some people uncomfortable. These may be, you know, it may take a lot of effort on all of our parts to achieve that improvement, that progress. It may challenge us in a lot of ways that may make us not want to vote for you, you know, because you're asking me to live up to a certain standard that I'm going to have to live up to bring about that improvement in our lives. And one thing that politicians have learned is don't make people uncomfortable unless it's uncomfortable with the other guy, with something he did.
You are saying, and you referred to numbers just a couple minutes ago about age of 47, lifetime 47 then, around 80 now. But you are saying that in 67 years, if my math is correct, that in 67 years we could be knocking at the door of immortality. So if we take the word change and look for a specific definition, exactly what do you mean by knocking at the door of immortality?
Well, I made that statement, quite frankly, in an interview with Reuters a few years ago, which then went all the way around the world. It has a bombastic kind of quality to it.
It's got a shelf life.
Excuse me?
It's got a shelf life.
Oh, absolutely, because it shows that people, for the most part, people embrace that idea, though it'd be interesting to see some of my email I got after that comment. I mean, we're certainly on the road to what I would consider super longevity, which would be living to 125, 150 years, but as relatively young people, because of breakthroughs in stem cells, in breakthroughs in genetic engineering, breakthroughs in arcane areas known as like nanotechnology, which could literally revolutionize what we think of as matter, as material, as kind of everything we know would be kind of thrown asunder by these developments. And we see it happening in the labs every day. A lot of these stories have a hard time bubbling up to the surface of the news cycle, because they may not be as sexy, or you hear about them in some context. You know, we've cured MS in multiple sclerosis in mice. Interesting. What does that mean? What does that do? Back to the next news cycle. But in reality, when you add these up on a day-to-day basis and you follow them like I do, and I do this professionally and because I'm just interested in these and I think they're important issues, you begin to get a concept of vastly an improving medical situation for us. And I know everyone may not be able to afford every one of these improvements at the same time, but they're occurring not just in the United States, but globally. And that's what's so exciting about it.
Wouldn't you think, though, that part of what you're talking about is the fact that the people who would be asking the questions don't understand the science that you're mentioning, specifically nanotechnology? If you take the average reporter, average age, regardless of where he or she went to school to study journalism, and regardless of the type of vehicle, whether it's electronic or print, and you sit that person down with someone who's an expert in nanotechnology, advancing some of the concepts that you're alluding to, which could extend an individual's life to 100 to 150 years, do you think the reporter would understand it?
Well, I think, because it can be easily articulated. It doesn't necessarily have to be scientifically explained. When people understand, when you say, well, we're going to build things from the bottom up, from one atom at a time,
mm-hmm.
and with that kind of capability, we could build just taking just the atoms sitting there, we could reprogram it and turn it into a piece of furniture, into a body part, into skin, into a diamond. People say, okay, it sounds far-fetched, but I understand what you're talking about. We haven't gotten there yet, by the way. I mean, we're nowhere near mastering the physics of getting that atom to control, like, to behave. They're in quantum reality, right? They don't do what they're supposed to do. They don't do what we'd like them to do. But when we can, I mean, at that point, you're going to start, you might as well start civilization all over because, you know, all of us will be manufacturing things in our houses that we're, you know, we couldn't even imagine doing, you know, very easily. And part of that would be developing organs that could be, that wouldn't age, developing little microscopic nanobots that would go through the bloodstream, eliminating viruses. Eliminating cancers without touching anything else within the bloodstream, kind of like a smart bug that would be going through, a smart machine going through the bloodstream. I mean, these are at least being discussed at this point, but I have to tell you that genetic engineering, which is basically taking place now, we're doing, you know, we've conquered the genetic code mm-hmm. in the sense we've unraveled this. We're now starting to use this and apply it to gene therapy. This was science fiction, I would say, only even 20 years ago. Even within the lifetimes of most of the people listening now, this is the kind of thing you saw in Star Trek, as well as nanotechnology, by the way. They used to call it the replicator in Star Trek, where you put something in and
right.
come out, the replication would come out in the machine next to it. But what is science fiction very often turns out to be real, and 20 years later, and most scientific breakthroughs, and this is one of the things I warn people about, most scientific breakthroughs, when they appear, seem like magic, because that's why they're a breakthrough. They seem like the thing of magic. Radio was that way. People who came through that era, and I knew people who literally saw the advance of radio, television, airplanes, you know, the first appearance, each one of these seemed magical. They seemed magical. They seemed like something that was working at a level that was so beyond human knowledge that it seemed magical.
Well, you mentioned 100 to 150 years lifespan. Let's take 150. As a futurist, do you necessarily believe that living to be on average of 150 years old is a good thing, or it's just something that's going to happen?
I think it will be a good thing for those who choose to embrace this. And let me explain what I mean by that. If we find, for instance, the aging gene, and some people have already claimed that they found that there are one or two genes that are implicated in aging, and we find ways to manipulate that either pre-birth or somehow in the human genome so that you eliminate this from, say, a family history, it would mean that the person didn't age and would die at a very old age, and would at that old age would be relatively young. I think that when that happens, obviously it's going to have tremendous implications for people, because we see the lifespan in very predictable, well, until recently, we saw the lifespan in very predictable ways. We're already being challenged by super longevity. Let's face that. If people were living to 47 in 1900 and they were living to 80 on average by 1990 or 2000, we've already added a piece of we've added a whole new stage to the lifespan. We don't know what to call it. Oh, and I agree with you. A lot of people don't even know what to do with it. I run into people who are 55, 60 now, and realize they're going to live for another 25 years. They feel absolutely wonderfully healthy. They feel invigorated, and there are always new ways to feel invigorated, new medications,
yeah,
new regimens,
yeah,
new vitamins, and they just don't know. There are things they can do, but they don't know where they fit. Am I retired? Am I old? Am I young? Am I still middle-aged? And how does society see me? Because remember, two-thirds of all the people who are 65 or whoever reached 65 are living now, which is mind-boggling when you think about it.
Wow.
So societies didn't have to deal with this except as old people. You know, these are people who kind of hung around. In the Roman Empire, if you reached 50, you were referred to as an ancient. Now, younger people may still refer to 50-year-olds that way, but generally, you know, at least in polite conversation, we don't do that.
I won't say what my grandsons refer to me as. Let's take a pause. Michael Zay is our guest, a futurist. And we'll invite your calls with comments at 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888-463-6748. The Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com. We'll be back.